Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. John McCauley of the band Deer Tick is one of my favorite frontmen, songwriters, rock and rollers. A great human being. Complicated guy. Weird guy. I don't think he would argue with that assessment. He's the truth behind the cliche, still waters run deep. Though to call John McCauley still waters is a bit like calling a tornado a gust of wind. He is, when he gets on stage at least, a tornado. He's crazy as a frontman, which I love about him. He's like Lux Interior. He's like, you know, Paul Westerberg on a good night. He's one of those frontmen where you imagine that he was born to do this thing. He was born to stand on a stage, command an audience, channel divinity, divine providence, to insert one of their album titles into this introduction. He's great. And I don't think he does a ton of the press for the band. I think Ian, who's also fantastic, is saddled with doing most of the face man talking work. And John, when you get him going, you realize there's a lot there. And I think he gets going pretty well during the course of this interview. I think you're going to love it. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. I know I did. It was good to reconnect with an old friend, and it was really great to get to pick the brain of an artist whom I admire as much as I do, John McCauley from Deer Tick. Welcome to Wheels Off, John McCauley. Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing pretty great, Rhett Miller. Nice to see you.
I won't repeat, you know, I'll tell our audience we had to do a restart for technical issues, but John and I did have a lengthy discussion about our gold teeth. John, you just got a second gold tooth.
I did last year. Yeah.
It looks so good. It's so sparkly. Yeah. You're like a pirate skull waiting to happen.
Yeah, I'm going to have to make a note in my will that my skull should be preserved. And decorated with an eye patch and a bandana and all that.
For the edification of the listening public, from where are you logging in?
I'm in Rhode Island at my house in the guest room.
And oh, nice. That's probably where you belong, at least half the time. And how long
only,
ago?
Only when I snore.
How long ago did y'all move back from Nashville?
It's been a few years. That first COVID summer, we spent up here on the beach, and by the end of the summer, we didn't want to go back, you know?
Well, it's probably nice to be so close to the bandmates too.
Yeah. And bandmates, family, all that, you know, we were kind of, you know, during lockdown, it was just the three of us, you know, my wife and my daughter, and, it was shitty, you know?
Yeah,
so
I bet.
Came up here, escaped the heat, and spent the summer on the beach. And we just looked at each other, Vanessa and I, and said, "We're not going back, are we?" You know.
Yeah, legit. So
that's that.
And you've got a whole setup to record there too, right? Sounds like.
Yeah, there's a carriage house behind the house, and we just converted it into a studio. And yeah, it's great. We can do everything. It's like our clubhouse now. We can record there. We can rehearse. We just did the whole production day there for the tour. It's just, it's a really great asset to have in the band.
I should know this. I feel like, is that where you made the new record?
No, we went out to Dave Fridman's studio in, where's it? Casadega, New York, middle of nowhere, Tarbox Road Studios.
God, now he, what a producer. I've always wanted to work with him. Was it super fun?
Yeah, it was really easy going. You know, he's not too precious about things. You know, we just got in there and, you know, played everything together. And, you know, if it felt good, then that's the take, move on, you know?
And it's been in the can for a while now.
We finished mixing it about 9 months ago.
Yeah.
Something. So
is that lag time weird for you? You know, I always think about that when you're waiting for a thing. And like, do you have any other projects that you've started working on since then? Are you stressed out at all?
This is the first record release tour that we're going on since, you know, in many years, and there's been a whole fucking global pandemic in the middle of that time. So it's a little nerve wracking getting back out there. Really want to do this new album, you know, do it justice and play the songs really well and play them like we've known them forever. So I'm putting a lot of pressure on myself, but I think we're getting pretty good results. We did the first show of the tour last night up in Deerfield, Mass. And I thought it went really well, and excited to get a few more under our belts. And we're going to be out all summer and all fall. But yeah, to answer your question, I think typically, like, you know, when we would be putting out a record every year or two, yeah, I hated that lag time. But this time around, it felt more like something we could work with. You know, we really rehearsed our asses off, which is unlike us in so many ways. But
did you have, I see, I'm about to go in the studio, so this is on my brain. The listeners will have to put up with me picking your brain a little bit about this. Did you have a ton of songs for the record, and then you had to make an A list from that? Was there a lot of negotiating down from whittling down lists, arguing about songs? How'd that go? Yeah.
We were over prepared. We had I think 20 songs or so. But we kind of wanted to make a punchy record, you know, not too many songs, or if it was a lot of songs, we didn't want a ridiculous runtime, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was very that was something we always wanted to do when we first started, was, you know, fill up every possible second of a compact disc. But those days are over, you know. People, if they're going to buy it physically, it's usually going to be vinyl. So we wanted to make sure it fit on one LP. And yeah, there were a lot of discussions, some hurt feelings, some all that stuff. But we had to find the songs in there that fit together well and did each other. You know, I guess what the fuck am I trying to say? Sorry, I got home at like 3 in the morning last night.
I know, I can't believe they scheduled you this the morning after the first show of the tour.
Well, thank you for accommodating me and doing it at 1 in the afternoon.
So. You're doing great, though, for what it's worth. Yeah, man, believe me, I know all about all of that, the sort of negotiation and compromise and diplomacy that goes into keeping everyone happy. How long Deer Tick now? How long has Deer Tick been existing, and how long has this current lineup been together?
I started the band in 2004. Mm-hmm. So it's
almost 20 years.
Yeah, we're getting up there. Let's see. Ian is the newest member, and he joined in 2009, I think. So, yeah. You know, It's been a while.
Yeah, it's funny to think of him as the newest member, but I guess that was 14 years ago.
Yeah.
He's so great. Yeah, man, you know I'm actually a giant fan of you and the band, and I'm just so excited. I really am hoping I can get out to one of these gigs on the tour, because, you know, Deer Tick Live is such a fucking experience.
Thank you.
I've never asked you much about how, like, the beginnings of it for you, and if you wouldn't mind, go back in time. And was there an epiphany moment for you as a kid where you knew you were going to do this? Was there a moment where you knew that, like, all square jobs and straight life was, you know, not an option for you, and that you were going to be a rock and roller? Do you remember that happening in your brain?
Yeah, I never really weighed my options. You know, I think, I don't know, some of my earliest memories is watching the fucking La Bamba movie. You know, I wanted that skyrocket to success. I wanted to rock and roll for a living, and hopefully not die in a plane crash. But, you know, I've made it this far.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, nothing else really interested me as I got older, as far as, you know, things that I could do with my life. I just wanted to play music and write songs, and, you know, I'm very fortunate, lucky I figured a little something out for myself. I did almost go to trade school for violin making and repair in Boston, but
wow,
they did not. Well, I say almost, but I didn't get accepted to the program. But if I did, that's what I was going to go into. But I don't know how long that would have lasted. I probably would have ended up in this chair talking to you over Zoom today anyway.
Was that pre-Deer Tick?
That was around the time Deer Tick started. Yeah.
Wow. It's so funny sometimes to think about those alternate lives that we didn't choose.
Yeah. Rhode Islanders, many of us be like, but, you know, I would never live in Boston, you know? So I can't believe I considered that. No offense to Boston. My dad's from Boston. I love Boston, but, you know, Providence is a little different pace.
I recently read a great Don Winslow book about mafia in Providence. I forget what it was called, but I kind of had never really thought of Providence as its own sort of mafia hot spot. You know, and they, of course, they had big bosses up in Boston that they had to deal with, but the Providence mob was its own weird, violent thing.
Yeah, for many years, the entire New England mafia was run out of Providence, out of the Federal Hill neighborhood. You know, there's a pretty seedy underbelly, or there was. I mean, it's cleaned up quite a bit, but if you know, well, this is a podcast, so there's a podcast out there, Crime Town. The first season is about Providence and kind of the relationship the mayor's office had with La Cosa Nostra, and it's pretty fascinating. And I kind of grew up, you know, I've seen these dudes around when I was a kid. It's pretty funny.
And there was a large Irish component to it as well in the book, apparently.
Yeah, in Boston. Boston was a big Irish mob town. Not so sure about Providence. I think it was more Italian territory.
Yeah. Anyway, this is all beside the point, but it's fascinating to me. And
no, it's good. It's like I've written songs about this shit. Like, it's really it informed a lot in me.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. There's a sort of a scary, like, I don't know. I feel like you as a songwriter, you keep your id, like your kind of animal side. It's always kind of in there somewhere. I feel like it's what makes you, it's what sets you apart as a songwriter. I, I feel like it's not super precious. It's this really kind of, I don't know, a very visceral way that you approach. I don't know if it's just sonic or maybe your choice of deaf, certainly your delivery, but would you agree with that? Do you feel like an animal dressed as a human?
In the earlier days, absolutely. Yeah, I think I feel a little bit more human nowadays, but you know, yeah, it's fun. I definitely used to write songs a little differently, just a little bit more free form, a little more stream of consciousness lyric stuff, and I've taken to really trying to carefully craft them now, just because I don't know, I'm changing, I'm older, I'm a different guy, and I don't know. I mean Hank Williams is kind of like the gold standard for a songwriter, and he's able to say so much with so few words. I mean, Tom Petty could do it, you know. Springsteen figured it out on Born in the USA big time. that's where I want to end up someday. Like, be able to paint an entire picture in your mind with 10 or 12 words, you know.
God, I love that. I just was talking about Zach from The Lone Bellow about this, and the idea of when you're young, feeling like you have to write from tragedy or perceived tragedy, or in my case, you know, poor life choices and drunkenness. And then as you get older, you start looking around going, Jesus, what am I going to write about now? I mean, I'm a dad with kids and some success.
But I think you're more tuned into what's going on in the world. And there's plenty of awful shit out there to still write about. But you know, it's not all doom and gloom with me. Nope. I think I got a couple almost, they're almost regular love songs on the record.
And I do think we get better, right? Would you agree as artists, you know, because we've done it more and more over the years, we get better?
I think so. I mean, I know that there are fans of ours that are really attached to earlier records, and no matter what we do, in their minds, it won't live up to it. But I think anybody kind of coming in who didn't know us before, I think could look at our entire body of work and really see the growth there. And I don't know, I think our newest record is, if not the best, it's up there, you know. I don't know. I think just a lot of Dyrtek is always either in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. And we were in the right place for this record, for sure.
I wonder, I mean, because I growing up, I certainly did that to bands where I would, you know, argue that only their early records, whatever. I wonder if that has more to do with the audience finding you at that impressionable age and those records imprinting themselves and seeming unapproachable by your later stuff. Like, it's not about us, it's about them.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it took me a while to figure out that the last two Replacements records were actually really great records, you know?
So I feel like, as much as sometimes I feel like your stage persona might make it seem otherwise, I feel like you're a pretty sensitive guy. And I only say that just because I feel like you're such a great front man, and you don't seem like you would ever have any, I don't know, of the sort of internally generated stuff that keeps us from achieving what we should artistically or being happy, or like the internally generated obstacles that everybody I've talked to so far deals with, whether it's success, guilt, or imposter syndrome, or just freaking anxiety or whatever. I wonder, when you come up against those things, what have you figured out as a way to get through that?
Oh gosh. I mean, my stage persona helps. Work some shit out on stage, but don't know. I don't know that I really have the plan there. I take things one day at a time, but I think you're right. I probably am a lot more sensitive and an introvert and shy and not a very sociable dude when I'm off stage. Like it's there's a switch gets flipped when I go up there, but yeah, I keep to myself a lot. And yeah, I guess writing songs helps. I don't know. I've tried more conventional approaches to these things like depression and doing too many drugs and all that. It's not for me. I do things my way, and I'm better off than I have been in decades,
That's great. I mean, I'm not going to say I was ever worried about you, but it's great to hear anybody say that they're better off than they've been. And you seem great, man. And the record is so good. I'm really proud of you. And I'm so glad to see that you guys are still doing it. 20-year anniversary next year. That's a whole reason for touring for all of 24.
Yeah, man. We gotta figure out what we're gonna do. I had an idea where we do a big like theater show in Providence, and we'd kind of bring in all the past members and past versions of the band, and kind of do a retrospective performance, like a long 2.5 hour show or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I think that's a good idea. I don't know.
Great. I feel like you're never afraid to try big, weird stuff.
No, not at all. I mean, it's I don't know. I like variety. Yeah, I like variety. And yeah, there was a time where like all I wanted to do was kind of just grab people from different bands and put them together and like see what we could do. With Metal Brother and then Diamond Rugs, and then I was trying to get a band together with Tommy Stinson and Marshall Crenshaw. That almost happened. I'm kind of sad it didn't, but
I mean, that could still happen. They're
it
both
could, yeah.
still around. That would be a, those are some ornery, crazy characters. But yeah, you
Yeah, I
included now
love
that I
them.
think about it. Yeah,
Yeah.
I love it. Oh my God. What would that band be called?
Don't know. I don't know. I think you'd have to get us in a room and kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I'd love that. I wonder if you would be willing to try and dispense a little di or distill maybe even the wisdom you've been sharing. Like, imagine a 21-year-old John McCauley in today's world. Well, what advice might you give this young you?
All right, the distillation process is going to be, I don't know. Maybe, no, what does a carpenter say? Measure twice, drill once, or whatever. Maybe if I could, yeah, figure out something along those lines, but maybe with like the bad contracts I signed or something.
Oh, really?
Read it twice, sign once. I don't
Oh, interesting.
know.
Do you?
No, I don't know. We were very naive. I think But it would have been nice, I guess, to talk to my older self just to give some reassurance that things are going to turn out all right. Things are definitely a lot better and a lot different than at some points I imagine they would be, you know.
Were you afraid it wasn't going well? Did you feel a lot of anxiety about it, younger you?
I was just so fucked up by the end of my 20s that I didn't really, I kind of, the tank was empty, you know. I just felt like I could drop dead at any moment. It was like, you know, I just thought one night I'm going to go to sleep and I'm not going to wake up. I felt like my
Holy.
body was just going to give up.
What
And
changed that?
meeting Vanessa was a huge change in my life. That was the first time I, you know, stopped drinking for more than 12 hours. You know, in many, many years. And yeah, just she gave me a new appreciation for life in general, mine and other people's.
It's funny, when I've been able to be around you, and watch you, even just beyond sort of frontman rock and roll, watch you make music. I don't know that people really appreciate how gifted you are, like as an instrumentalist and just as like someone who, I don't even know if I would call it music theory because I don't know that you've studied it, but the way you are able to build like architectural structures of music, I feel like is something that people may or may not appreciate about you. My question is it something that you realize or take pride in? Like, are you able to sort of think of yourself as someone that's got like a real, unique, extraordinary talent?
Well, thank you. That's very flattering of you to say and recognize. That's another thing where that kind of developed as I got a little older. I just wanted to be a better musician. You know, I love the way Kurt Cobain plays the guitar as much as I love the way Danny Gatton plays the guitar. And you know, and one is technically way more proficient than the other, but they both do things that the other guy can't. And I think I relied heavily on this kind of, I don't need to know what I'm doing kind of attitude for a while. And then I got kind of bored with it. And, you know, I would think it was really funny, like to fuck up a guitar solo, you know. I mean, it's hilarious, but you know, after a while that kind of wears off and you're starting to think like, what are all these people watching me thinking, you know? So yeah, I started you know, I bought some guitar books and stuff, and this is like in my 30s, like just try and understand more about music and figure out new pathways through it and exercise my fingers a little bit more and just gain a deeper knowledge and understanding of what I do. And of course, I have a lot of bad habits from my punk rock attitude years. And I'm not going to work too hard to get rid of them because it kind of, it makes me sound like me. But yeah, I'm still really fascinated by music. I think all the guys in Dirt Tick are, and we're all still trying to learn and grow. And you know, anything could happen next, you know, creatively. That's kind of our how. That's our MO nowadays.
And I feel like that's really your calling card is that every one of your records is wildly different, and every one of your records shows a band pushing the envelope. So I just, I think that's a big part of why I'm such a fan. And I'm so grateful that you sat down to share some of this wisdom. And I really appreciate you waking up after your first night of the tour.
Well, it's all right, man. I woke up at 11:30. It's been a couple hours. I had a couple of coffees. I'm good.
Oh, man. Well, listen, tell Vanessa I said hi.
I hope.
I hope our paths cross soon. I really want to see this tour. And, man, I just think the world of you. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, I love you, Rhett. Thank you, man, for having me.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.